That's how it all begins. The opening bars of Das Rheingold, the first opera of Richard Wagner's Der Ring des Nibelungen, or The Ring of the Nibelungs. Hello, I'm Andrew Davis, Music Director of Lyric Opera of Chicago. Every year I conduct several operas at Lyric. My job is never dull, and I look forward to each new season with great anticipation. For me, our 16-17 season is especially appealing, and it opens with Richard Wagner's Das Rheingold, a work that is thrilling, sublime, and enormously engaging. But it's only an introduction. Das Rheingold is a single-act, 2.5-hour opera, or, as Wagner's subtitle puts it, a preliminary evening. Obviously, it's preliminary to the other Ring operas that follow. The four of them, Das Rheingold, Die Walküre, Siegfried and Goethe Dämmerung, fully tax the musical, dramatic and stage resources of any opera company. We'll be getting to those other three operas in the coming seasons. This year, though, it is Rheingold, the shortest of the Ring operas. Think of it as a warm-up lap for a challenging but thoroughly rewarding Wagner marathon. Lyric Opera of Chicago's first season was in 1954. It wasn't until the conclusion of the 1995-96 season that the company offered its first complete Ring cycle, and that could only be accomplished after a major renovation that greatly expanded the backstage scenery handling area. Before we delve into Das Rheingold, I'd like to offer a few words about its creator. Consider this. At the time of its premiere in 1876, Wagner's Ring cycle was the most ambitious, spectacular, and impressive theatrical event in human history. And the story, libretto, music, nearly everything associated with it were the work of one man. Unlike Mozart or Beethoven, Wagner was not a prodigy. His musical gifts didn't become apparent until he was well into adulthood. But long before his first operatic success, Wagner felt he was placed on earth to do great things. When he was 22 years old, he bought a large notebook. His idea was to record every detail of his life so that writing his autobiography would be easier. From the start, Wagner believed that someday he would have a rendezvous with destiny. And he did. Along with giving us The Flying Dutchman, Tannhäuser, Lohengrin, Die Meistersinger, and Tristan und Isolde, Wagner created this cycle, one of the most monumental structures in all art. It took him more than a quarter century to complete it. The scope of it was immense, and Wagner didn't think he would live to see The Ring performed. The forces needed for a performance are considerable, and for that first Ring, a special theatre had to be built to accommodate the composer's artistic vision. Of course, Wagner designed it. The Bayreuth Festspielhaus, which was completed for the 1876 world premiere of the Ring cycle, was a performing facility unlike anything ever seen. When you entered the theatre, you left the outside world and stepped into the world of Richard Wagner. The orchestra pit was sunken, and the orchestra hidden from the audience view. There were no boxes for the wealthy. It's all very democratic, and with no aisles between seats, audience members are prevented from getting up and walking around during performances. But what Wagner did that radically changed the opera experience for everyone was that he darkened the house so that the audience focused on the only source of light, the stage. This was a major step in moving opera from mere entertainment to something far greater. Basically, the story of the entire Ring cycle rests on the simple action of the Nibelung Alberich. He steals the gold from the Rhine and upsets the cosmic balance of things. Eventually, after four evenings of opera containing some of the most heroic, brilliantly orchestrated and sublime music ever written, balance is restored. While Das Rheingold is short when compared to the other Ring operas, there are quite a few characters. Let's start with the gods. Wotan, he's the ruler of the gods. Donner is god of thunder. Fro is god of spring, and Loge is the god of fire. There are two giants, Fasolt and Fafner. Together they build Valhalla. And central to the Rheingold story are the two Nibelungs, Alberich and Mime. They're brothers, and members of a race of dwarves who live beneath the earth. For years, Wagner had delved into Norse mythology and sagas. For his Ring, he borrowed heavily from them. His early sketches, scenarios, and drafts occupy several hundred pages of manuscript. In 1848, he completed his first detailed prose sketch of the story. Of course, he made revisions, refinements, and modifications, but that 1848 sketch was the basic plan of what was to become the Ring Cycle. The opening sentences of Wagner's sketch of 1848 certainly capture the essence of that subterranean race. Out of the womb of night and death, there came into being a race dwelling in Nibelheim. They are known as the Nibelungs. Feverishly they burrow through the bowels of the earth like worms in a dead body. That's quite an image. In addition to gods and Nibelungs, Wagner gives us goddesses. There's Fricka, wife of Wotan, Freya, sister of Fricka and the goddess of youth, beauty and feminine love, and the very wise Erda, the Earth Mother. There are also those three sensuous nymphs, the Rhine Maidens, Woglinda, Wellgunda and Flosshilda. As we just heard, Wagner's score begins with a very long sustained E-flat in the double basses, which goes on for 136 bars. Wagner said that the seemingly endless drone portrays the ceaseless flow of the River Rhine. He also said that effect came to him when he was half asleep. As the stage action begins, the Rhine Maidens, Woglinda, Wellgunda and Flosshilda, frolic about while guarding the Rhine's gold. Here's some of that music. The Rhine Maidens soon notice Alberich, a Nibelung. Alberich lusts after them, but is not blessed with good looks. In fact, he's grotesquely ugly. All three Rhine Maidens reject his advances. But they explain to him that whoever wears a ring fashioned from the Rhine's gold will possess absolute wealth and power. There's a catch, though. To possess the gold, one must forever relinquish love. To their surprise, remember, Alberich had just been pursuing all three of them. He curses love, grabs the gold, and escapes.
Der Welterbe gewinn ich zu eigen durch dich. Erzwing ich dich Liebe, doch nicht dich erzwing ich mir Lust.
The second scene could be a modern domestic drama, and in some recent productions that's exactly what it is. Below a mountaintop fortress, the goddess Fricka, who is married to Wotan, ruler of the gods, remember, complains to her husband. It's no big thing, just that Wotan has promised Fricka's sister Freya as payment to the giants Fasold and Fafner for their building the gods a new home. Freya, if you remember, is the goddess of youth and beauty and feminine love. And if that isn't enough, it is Freya's golden apples that keep the gods eternally young. Without her around, the gods will quickly age. Just what was Wotan thinking when he made that deal? It doesn't matter. Wotan dispatches Loga to look for something else to give the giants instead of giving them Freya. But she suddenly rushes in, followed by the giants Fasolt and Fafnir. Fasolt demands payment for their finished work. He points out that Wotan's authority is sustained by the treaties carved into his spear, including his contract with the giants. Donna, the god of thunder, and Fro, the god of spring, attempt to defend their sister Freya. Wotan stops them. A deal's a deal. And because he's the ruler of the gods, he can't permit them to use force to break the agreement. Loga finally returns and reports that he's found only one instance where somebody gave up love for something else. It was Alberich, the Nibelung, who has now made a magic ring from the gold. Fafnir says that he and his brother will accept the Nibelung's treasure as payment instead of taking Freya. Wotan doesn't immediately agree, so the giants take Freya as their hostage and leave. Their plan is to keep her forever if they don't get the gold by that evening. Wotan then decides to head for Alberich's kingdom beneath the earth to get the gold. Loga will be his guide.
Auf Loge, hinab mit mir, nach Nibelheim fahren wir nieder. Gewinnen wir das Gold.
Ihr Leinköpfe, verlief dich an, so dürfen wir hören, sie hoffen.
Schweige, Schwänzchen, Freier, die Gute, Freier gibt es zu lösen.
Wie du befiehlst, hör ich dich gern, steil geht ab, steigen wir denn durch den Rhein.
Mit um den Rhein.
While the Ring Cycle is full of all kinds of characters, it's the orchestra that's the principal protagonist. Wagner was a wizard in his development of thematic material, and he had a wonderful knack for handling orchestral forces. Between scenes 2 and 3, he inserts an orchestral interlude depicting Wotan and Loge's descent into Nibelheim. As scene 3 opens, there's a choir of anvils beating out the rhythm of the Nibelung theme. Let's listen to this masterful transition.
Thank you.
Wotan and Loga encounter Mime, who tells them that things are bleak in Nibelheim. His brother Alberich and his ring have brought misery to the Nibelungs. Alberich has made slaves of them and has forced them to pile up a huge mound of gold. Alberich has also forced Mime to create the Tarnhelm, a magic helmet that makes its wearer invisible. But that's not all the Tarnhelm is capable of. It can also change the wearer's shape, as well as teleport him great distances. Alberich boasts to Wotan and Loga about his plans to use the gold for world domination, and he tells them about the Tarnhelm and its magic. Loga's skeptical, at least he acts that way, so Alberich turns into a giant dragon. Loga's impressed, and then cleverly asks Alberich if the Tarnhelm could make him tiny as well. Alberich, pumped up by all this attention and flattery, stupidly turns himself into a toad. Loga and Wotan easily capture him and drag him to the mountaintop. It is there, on the mountaintop, that they force Alberich to exchange his wealth for his freedom. He uses the ring to summon his Nibelung slaves, who bring along the hoard of gold. After the gold's been delivered, Alberich asks for the return of the Tarnhelm, but Loga says it's part of the ransom. Finally, Wotan demands the ring. Alberich refuses, but Wotan tears it off his finger and puts it on his own. Alberich wasn't that bothered by losing the gold, because he felt he could get it back by using the magic ring. But now that he's lost the ring, Alberich is completely despondent. He lays a curse on it, and it's quite a curse. Until the ring is returned to him, everyone will want it, and whoever has it will be killed and robbed of it by its next owner. In other words, even though it's coveted by everyone, no good can come of possessing it. Fasold and Fafner return with Freya. By this time, the gods are growing weak without her. Fasold says that the gold should be piled high enough to hide her from view. To accomplish this, Wotan has to include the Tarnhelm with the gold. But Fasold spots a tiny space in the pile which allows one of Freya's eyes to be seen. He demands that Wotan fill the space with the ring. Wotan, being Wotan, says he'll keep it for himself. The giants grab Freya and start to leave, and this time they plan to leave permanently. But Erda, the earth goddess and the possessor of great wisdom, appears and warns Wotan of impending doom. She persuades him to give up the cursed ring. He does that, and the giants are finally satisfied. They release Freya. As the giants divide the treasure and argue about the ring, Fafner clubs Fasold to death. Wotan now understands that Alberich's curse is for real. The gods now prepare to enter their new home, which is hidden in a mist. Donner swings his hammer and summons a thunderstorm to clear the air. After the storm has ended and the clouds have vanished, Fro creates a rainbow bridge that stretches to the gate of the new castle. Wotan leads them across the bridge to the castle, which he names Valhalla. Loge, though, hesitates. He sees that the gods are hastening their end and wonders whether he should join them. Far below, the Rhine maidens call out to Wotan to give the gold back. He ignores them. The gods are now at their zenith, but by the end of the fourth opera, the curse will catch up with them. Wagner wrote his Ring cycle over the course of many years, and ever since the 1876 premiere in the Bayreuth Festspielhaus, these many hours of music and drama have been regarded as the greatest single operatic achievement in history. The Ring is a work that holds a unique place in Western culture. Obviously, Richard Wagner accomplished much. He changed music. Some will say he changed the world. He was a driven, impossible man. He was selfish. In fact, the term self-centered doesn't begin to describe him. He always considered himself first, frequently borrowed money and never repaid it, fathered children with another man's wife, and he dominated every conversation he was ever involved in. He loved to talk, as long as he was talking about himself. Saying he was conceited would be an understatement. He was completely self-possessed, constantly self-promoting, and as we would say in this century, he was forever starring in his own movie. Putting it simply, his colossal ego and his complete disregard for the feelings of others made him unlikable. That said, he was one of the greatest composers of all time and one of the greatest dramatists of his generation. He not only changed opera, he changed people's expectations of opera. But he came from humble beginnings. His father, Carl Friedrich Wagner, was a Leipzig police officer, and his mother Johanna was a baker's daughter. Neither was musical. But Wagner's paternity is somewhat tricky. When Carl Friedrich died, only 6 months after Wagner's birth, close friend of the family Ludwig Geyer took charge of the family's affairs. He and Johanna were married the following year. Most believe that it was Geyer who was Wagner's biological father, not Carl Friedrich. Geyer was a lover of great literature, a writer, and a portrait painter. And despite his death when Wagner was only 8, he instilled in his stepson a love of culture. But it was literature, not music, that first appealed to the young man. Early on, he was so enthralled with the Homeric epics that he studied Greek so that he could read them in their original language. When he was 14, he wrote a poetic drama which was inspired by the Greeks and Shakespeare. The young playwright killed off 42 characters in the first 4 acts, but then had some of them reappear as ghosts in the 5th. Wagner first discovered his love of music at a performance of Weber's Der Freischütz, but that was mere love. after he heard the Beethoven symphonies at the Gewandhaus in Leipzig, followed by a performance of Fidelio, his feelings toward music moved from love to obsession. He neglected his schoolwork and struggled for a book on music theory, which he borrowed from Friedrich Wieck, the father of Clara Schumann. He wrote piano arrangements of the Fifth and Ninth Symphonies and the Missa Solemnis. His first try at operas came at age 20 with Die Feen, or The Fairy. His second opera, Das Liebesverbot, or The Ban on Love, was based on Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. His Rienzi premiered successfully in 1842, and soon came Der Fliegende Holländer, or The Flying Dutchman, the first Wagner opera that really sounds like Wagner. One of the defining characteristics of Wagner operas is the composer's use of leitmotifs. Throughout the entire Ring cycle, Wagner uses leitmotifs, or very brief musical ideas, that are placed in the score so the listener can associate them with a particular character or idea or emotion, or even a particular place. That's the leitmotif that Wagner assigns to the Rhine Maidens. It recurs several times in Das Rheingold. Wagner uses other leitmotifs for the individual gods, the giants, the Nibelungs. He also assigns leitmotifs to the Tarnhelm, the Rheingold, and even then to certain ideas, love and youth, for example. The leitmotif is usually sounded in the orchestra at the first appearance or mention of an object, character, or idea. Think of them as musical labels. They link the musical score with the story unfolding on stage. Unlike Mozart, Verdi, Strauss, or almost any other opera composer, Wagner wrote his own librettos. Most operas begin with a non-musical playwright putting together a libretto and then handing it to a composer who sets the words and action to music. This then is handed to a director, scenic and costume designers, and of course singers and orchestra and conductor, all of whom influence, some more than others, the final product, a fully realized opera. In Wagner's case, things were different. At least they began differently. Wagner the musician guided Wagner the poet and dramatist at every phase of the story. Wagner was an opera creator. He authored the original story, produced a libretto, and then composed all the music. And he did this for not just his Ring cycle, but for all his other operas too. Today, more than 130 years after his death, we are still talking about Wagner and studying his works. Even in the 21st century, he continues to influence our thinking about opera, music, and art. I hope you enjoy Das Rheingold, and in the coming seasons, join us for the other three Ring operas as well. The recorded examples you've heard are from the Teldec Classic recording of the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, with permission from Warner Classics. This commentary script was prepared by Jack Zimmerman.